Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson and Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Hello and welcome to Let's Talk. Before we begin, I'd firstly like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land where our studios are based here at West End. I'd also like to acknowledge our elders, elders of the more recent arrivals and our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander elders listening to us either through 98.9 FM or through our 98.9 FM app or through the National Indigenous Radio Service. Carver Watson is here with us today.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Thanks for having us.
And Carver, quickly. Your mob?
Yeah, my mob are Birriggubba and Kungaloo people of central Queensland regions, Dawson River and Nebo region.
And we're joined today by a couple of fellas from south of the border. We're not going to make too much of a thing about that, are we?
Nah.
Are we over the whole state of origin?
I think
they'd
be Wait a minute.
They're with an organisation called Brothers for Recovery. So, Steve, if I could get you firstly to introduce yourself and tell us your mob.
Yeah, I'm Steve. I'm a Barkindji man from Far West New South Wales, living on Darkinjung, up on the central coast of New South Wales, and co-founder of Brothers for Recovery.
And what about you, Jeff?
Yeah, my name's Jeff Amato. I'm a proud Wiradjuri man from Wellington, New South Wales, and I'm based on the central coast myself, Darkinjung land, and I'm the other co-founder for Brothers for Recovery too.
So, what is Brothers for Recovery?
Brothers for Recovery is a drug and alcohol and mental health awareness program. What we do is we go to schools and communities and jails and all those sort of things, juvenile justice centres, and pretty much just share our journeys through addiction and alcoholism, through our mental health struggles and the life that come with it. Obviously, there's a lot of with different stories. We're both from completely different backgrounds, but both went through a lot of crime and a lot of addiction and come through the other end to tell our stories. So we get out to communities and pretty much the aim around our whole program is to start a conversation and encourage people to go get help.
So what is your story? Like, if you don't mind me asking, you know, how did you come to, obviously you identified the need and you said, you know, he's gone through this stuff yourself. Like, how did you come to the point where you realised that, you know, it wasn't just youth fellows that were going through this stuff and, you know, that a lot of people had that same story in it?
Yeah, well, how it all come to a start, Brothers for Recovery, was me, Steve, and another brother who had to step aside for personal reasons. I had to locate to the Central Coast, you know, and I had to go up there to get help for myself at a rehab there called the Glen. It's an Indigenous rehab, you know, and for a long time, I suffered the life of drug addiction, alcoholism, the crime, and the life that comes with it, you know, and I went up there and I bettered my life, and 8.5 years later, I'm still up there, still clean and sober, you know, and a lot of the mob from back home are reaching out to us saying, how are you doing it? You know, because for a long time, me personally, I thought that this life was normal. You know, you see it in the household on a day-to-day basis, you start to believe that it's normal, you know, and for a long time, I went through a lot of misery and pain before I knew that it's far from normal to live a life, to get up of a morning, to do crime of a night, and to put your Centrelink dole form in through the day, you know. And a lot of people saw my rock bottom back home and seen how far I scooped before I got help and said, well, how do you do it? If you can do it, surely we can do it, you know. So me and Steve, I got together and we said, let's go back to our communities and hold some community forums and let our mob know how we done it, you know. And we started a Facebook page, you know, and we went to five communities out west, you know, and Warren, Wellington, Condo, Forbes, and just told our story and tried to inspire others. And 2 days before that week finished, we got more interest saying, could you come to our communities? And we had to sort of take another week off work because I was full-time on railway pretty much, and Steve was working at AMS on the Central Coast. Yeah, here we are 14 months later and we've had to chuck our job in, you know, and stay on the road, and 14 months later we're still doing the same thing.
Deadly. Now, I think we've all got family who've, you know, suffered substance abuse and all those sorts of things, and, you know, one of the things that I guess, you know, that I hear when we hear rehab, it's like it's just one of those temporary things, you know, mob always going to rehab and then leaving and then going back there.
And falling back into the cycle.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, what's the sort of is you know, the 12-step program something that, you know, that you support through that sort of traditional model of rehabilitation, or support more the, like, the community controlled ones?
Jeff and I are both sort of members of the 12-step program. We're both heavily involved in that, but that's not what we do our program around. Mm. Our program is just based around the person themselves and going to get help. We don't, we don't obviously put out there that we obviously spread that we are members of it, and it's what got me clean and sober. I still continually go to it, but what we do generally is go and start that conversation, try and get people to get help, let them realise that rehab isn't like services. An institution. It's not like a jail, it's not like a hospital, it's not like a mental health ward, rehab, you know. And with the one Jeff went through, you know, on the Central Coast, it's an Indigenous man's rehab, and the first thing you'd go there, your very first day, they'll put ochre on your face and you sit around a fire, you know. And that's what sort of Jeff shares about in his journey, that he sort of got disconnected from culture, culture for so long, and then when he sat around that fire and put ochre on his face, things started to turn for him because he was disconnected from that for so long. A lot of people at rehabs, they don't get to feel that, you know. A lot of other rehabs, unfortunately, they're not culturally appropriate, you know. Some you go there and your first day you get put to church, and which is okay, you know, for some people. For Aboriginal people, it's not.
Yeah, that was the question I was going to ask. Like, is that the sort of, yeah, for so many of our mob who aren't, you know, sticking with the 12 steps or whatever it is it that thing of,
well,
not for me.
Personally for me, I had to change everything about my lifestyle, you know, and if that was moving away from the environment where it's all happening, I had to do that, you know. And like I said, I moved to the Central Coast in 2010, you know, and I couldn't go back home if I wanted the better of my life, you know. That's where my old playground is. That's where my old environment is. That's where everything's happened, you know. So, but going to that rehab, I believe culture was a big part of as a black fella to heal, you know. To sit around the fire and yarn like our people did thousands and thousands of years ago, and I believe that was a big impact for me to heal, you know. And we sat around the fire and just to hear other men speaking and telling their journeys, and just realised I'm not the only brother going through this, you know. And but like I said, my probably biggest advice was I took from a lot of people, a lot of old unks on the Central Coast, that you've got to start a new environment, you know, because there's nothing back home, you know what I mean. But for me, as a proud Aboriginal man, I have to go home at least 3 or 4 times a year. You know, I have to go home, and that's what I do, you know. Home will always be home, but my life is now, I've met a partner on the Central Coast, I've made a beautiful young family on the Central Coast, and them kids have never seen their dad drink or drug, you know, and it's a far cry from what I've seen, you know, and that's what it's all about. It's about breaking the chain for the next generation, you know, and that's my big vision of Brothers for Recovery, you know. We've got to start, we've got to start now, instead of saying in 20 years' time we should have tried to do something then, you know.
You mentioned a partner there. As the only Indigenous woman in this conversation, how can your sisters, mothers, partners, you know, support fellas going through the kind of things that you two have had to deal with?
Yeah, I guess my partner's seen through it all. You know, she was with me in addiction, seen me through my hard times trying to stop and get help, and then now sees the benefits of sticking around, you know. But she was one of them people that sort of had to say, you know, go. She didn't always support what I'd done. She hated what I'd done. But luckily enough, she stuck around. But we every single day, me and Jeff will get a message, a phone call, an email off a worried grandmother, an auntie, a mother, saying, how do I help? How do I stop him? How do I help him? And the thing is, you can't, unless he wants to.
Unless he wants that help himself.
Unless he wants that help, he's not going to stop, which is hard to tell him. And unfortunately, me and Jeff both got to stages where our mothers said, you're not allowed in our homes.
So ultimatums sometimes work or may
You've
not.
You've got to let that person go and hit their rock bottom. If you keep giving them that warm bed and that feed when they're coming down off their drugs, and
all
they're
that
going to
$50 or $100 a day to help feed their habit. And it's hard. It's hard to sing a mum would have to do is to tell their son they have to go.
Yeah.
You know, and I personally, me, I'm my mum's eldest child, you know, and we've got a bond there that it's just nothing like the other kids' bond, because my mum was a single parent and she reared me pretty much without my father, and the bond we must have had growing up, and for her to say, son, I love you, but you got to go.
It's some hard stuff, yeah, because I remember when my mum said, you know, you're not allowed in this house anymore. You know, she, tears were rolling down her face, and she said, I love you, but you're not allowed in my house anymore.
That'd be tough.
Yeah, it is. It's and that's the thing with our stories. It's pretty raw and it's pretty emotional, and we like to sort of to get services on board to because we come to communities and we open up a can of worms, you know. Mm-hmm. And what we like to invite a lot of services along to our talks, you know, like just EdSpace, AMSs, whatever, to because a lot of our people don't know help's there. You know, a lot of our people are too ashamed to go and get help, you know, and I'm only speaking for myself. I was so ashamed to ask for help for so long, you know, and what that nearly done, it nearly put me 6 foot under, you know. So that's pretty much what we, and with my partner, I'm pretty much lucky enough. I met my partner while I was in recovery, you know, so she hasn't seen sort of both sides of the coin with me, thank God, you know, but she knows about my past, you know, and, you know, like Steve said, it was the hardest thing. Our partners had, his partner and his mum and my mum tell us to do is just go, you know, so.
We just had, you know, because of her, we can. Mm. I think, you know, for us, the stories are always coming through around the strength, you know, of our women in the community. And, I mean, that's not an easy thing to do, you know what I mean? Quite often it's the mothers that are thinking, I've got these young fellas here, you know, that we can't have that stuff around or whatever reason it is. They have to make that decision, and that's, you know, it is a hard thing, but such is the strength of so many women in our community, you know, is that they, yeah.
And it was easier for my mum. There was less stress there for her to say go. You know, there's still stress there knowing that her son's out there. She doesn't know she's going to get a phone call at night. She doesn't know where he is. But it was less stress than me walking in and out all hours of the night, me bludgeoning off of me, mum having to come into the hospital every once a month. It was less stress for her to say, son, go. You know, like, so pretty much it did me the world of good for her to say that. And she's, there's nothing better than going back home and picking my mum up and saying, let's go down and fill your basket up with some food, mum. And she pretty much cries every time she sees me, you know, and she, you know, because she's got a son back.
And what does it mean to you to be able to do that? You know, knowing the sort of heartache that you cause through the dramas and the stress and all that sort of stuff, to go back now and...
Oh, it's a warm feeling. You know, I know the expression on my mum's face when she opens that door and she knows her elder son's in town again, and just to say, come on, mum, let's go to Coles, you know, and to sit down and have a yarn, you know, we can talk now. Like before, it was, I was either asleep or I was gone, I was locked in the room, I had no connection with my own mum, you know, but now it's sit down and have a cuppa, have a yarn, have a feed, and like I said, I was lucky enough to win the Indigenous Community Person of the Year National Dreamtime Award in Sydney, you know, not long ago, and mum celebrated for a week, you know. She celebrated for a week and she put her son on a pedestal every hour she was having to charge at, and, you know. But, yeah, no, it's just stuff like that, you know, to go back and see the old girl, it's priceless.
So when you wake up in the morning, do you pinch yourself? Like you can't believe you are where you are 8 years down the track?
Yeah, I do. You know, one of my favourite quotes is you know, I lived the life today I dreamt of in addiction. You know, and I truly do. You know, they say it's not all about materialistic things when you get clean and sober. When you're growing up for so long with nothing, you know, on a night to night, me and my brother had to pretty much share each other's clothes. You know, and so I know what it's like to do it tough. You know, and to start accumulating some materialistic things, it feels good. You know, knowing I'm sitting down in front of a TV with my kids and I'm providing them with a nice warm bed, you know, they can go to the fridge and they can get a feed when they want, you know. It was a far cry from what I used to be, you know. And I wake up every morning and I think, how did a little black fella get here? You know, but I'll tell you what, a lot of hard work, it wasn't given to me. You know, I had to put the actions in and the reward started paying off.
Yeah, let's not start talking about all those myths, say, that black fellas get all this, that and the other. That's another 3 hour conversation there.
It's a lot of hard work.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service and on 98.9 FM. We're talking to Jeff and Steve, who are with the program Brothers for Recovery.
This lonely heart keeps reminding me of you. inside keep telling me it's over. But I still love you, Curry Rose. In the evening we stroll down by the river, and as the golden moon shines brightly up above, there we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows. I'd whisper words of love to Curry Rose. But now she's gone, it seems my world has ended, and without her the stars no longer glow. Though they say we should part, she took part of my heart, and only God knows how I miss my Curry Rose. Stroll down by the river as the golden moon shines brightly up above. There we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows. I'd whisper words of love to Curry Rose. Up above, there we'd watch the rippling water as the river softly flows. I'd whisper words of love to Curry Rose. Just remember, I still love you, Curry Rose.
Brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. This is Carver Watson
and Karen Durante
with Let's Talk.
You're listening to Let's Talk here on the National Indigenous Radio Service and on 98.9 FM. We're talking to Jeff and Steve, who are with the program Brothers for Recovery. What's your story? You've been very quiet there. So you have, how long have you been in recovery, so to speak?
Yeah, so I'm a little bit different than Jeff. Jeff's the one that came and picked me up when I finally put my hand up for help. Mm-hmm. I've just got over a year and a half clean sober. Finished with pretty much 10 years of alcoholism and drug addiction, and come to a point where I just, enough's enough. I was sick and tired of being down and out, sick and tired of not being there for my kids and my partner and being broke and all that sort of thing. And yeah, it came to a point where I put my hand up and I sent Jeff a message and said, how do you do it? You know, I'm ready for help, you know, and he come and pick me up. And
so you knew each other before this?
We had mutual friends. We weren't close mates, but we had mutual friends. And Jeff said, I'll come and pick you up, you know, and he picked me up at night time and drove me out to that rehab we were talking about. And I still remember sitting in that car driving out there at night time, and it was just like a load off my chest already after 10 years. You know, it's something I've never ever done, is ask for help, and the moment I did it, I got it.
And you worked in an Aboriginal medical service?
I was working at Aboriginal medical service, and pretty much, I was drinking every single day, every night.
So you were around with people who sort of knew about all the health risks and all that kind of stuff, but I guess addiction being what it is, you know.
And I was still coming off, I was a man who was full of ego. You know, I was a man who, I guess, I had a lot of people around me that knew me as well. I played a lot of football, from sort of 16 to 20, 21. You know, I signed my first NRL contract at 16 and moved to Sydney, and I was pretty much as soon as I turned 18, I picked up that one. Couldn't put it down for 10 years, you know. I was kicked out of 3 NRL clubs within 4 years and never looked back, you know. My journey for the next 10 years was in pubs, in drug houses, in bars and in tabs, you know, betting, gambling, drinking. And that was my life for 10 years and pretty much wound up on the Central Coast. As I said, my partner, she provided me a platform at home where I could sort of sustain life with drinking. But it came to a point where I couldn't sustain that anymore. I couldn't stop on my own terms. And she pretty much said, go. Mm. And I said, I'll go get help, you know. And she said, I've heard it all before, whatever, you know. But
so she was sceptical.
She was sceptical, yeah. And I didn't know how much damage I'd done to that woman. She's a woman who's never drank. You know, she's a 26-year-old woman. She's never drank. She's always been there for the kids. She's a strong woman, you know, and I don't know how I landed it, to be honest, but even my mother, you know, now that I'm in recovery, my mother said to me, you know, I wish I found your partner 6 or 7 years ago, you know, it would have saved me a lot of heartache, you know. So that it just shows how important that woman is to me, you know, and we're getting married in 10 weeks' time now.
So you've been the supportive groom and been making a lot of decisions, or is it all her domain?
Yeah, I just said, give me a time and place and I'll be there.
Katie's getting married at the end of the year too. So. I think they're going to do a segment called Bridezilla.
So. Yeah, I don't know why.
You might have another guest on the show there. You want to jump in the arm.
Nah, she's looking forward to it. She's beaming with it, you know, because, you know, it was only 2 years ago. It's a strong word, but she hated me. She hated me in the house. It made her feel sick. You know, that's how bad it was. And even Jeff asked her when I was in recovery in front of me, you know, he said, my partner Zyra, you know, how do you feel about the changes in Steve, you know? She said, oh, you know, I hated him. I didn't want him in the house, but he had nowhere else to go. And to the point where she said when he picked my daughter up off the landing floor, it made me feel sick. I didn't know what was going to happen, you know. And that stuff hurts, but it's what I needed to hear.
Both of you talk about how, you know, alcohol and it's that sort of thing, there's this normalised behaviour that, you know. So I'm thinking in terms of the wedding, there's always a lot of bloody booze at a wedding. What's your plan of attack for that?
As I said, I'm involved with my program. I still go to my meetings every week. I'm strong enough to say no. I know it's going to be around, but I've got a lot of people in that room who got me into recovery and who are cleaning over themselves.
Yeah.
You know, like Jeff, and I've got another group of mates who drink. And I'm pretty lucky, my partner's side of the family, you know, 90% of them don't drink alcohol.
That's good. That's one bill you don't have to worry about for the wedding, eh?
Yeah, so I've tried to hit my mother and father up, so you can worry about the bar tab, eh?
Yeah, with the alcohol too, you just I believe that it's a number one killer for our mob. You know, you look at the statistics; it's killed more of our mob than any drug has, you know. Yeah. And because
it's tobacco, smoking,
tobacco, and alcohol, but because it's sold on every corner, because it's on every second ad, that's okay, you know. But I'm a man that I always like to have a look at statistics here, and alcohol's killed more of our mob than any drug has, you know. And I'm not long, probably in the last month, I've had to go back home for sorry business because of alcohol put our mob in the ground, you know. And I'm not against anyone who likes a sociable drink, you know. If they can do that, that's good on you, go for it. But a lot of our mob don't know when to put it down, you know. A lot of our mob wake up on a daily basis and, like myself, seeing it, thinking it's normal.
You know, like a crutch sort of thing. It's something that people fall, lean on or fall back on. And that's sort of next question I wanted to ask is, you know, obviously, you know, in your work and the stuff that you're doing now, you see a lot of fellas that are in the same boat. And clearly, you know, there's a lot of things that you've gone through that you identify, you know, Steve's gone through. And I guess it'd be the same yarn no matter what community you go, you see fellas dealing with the same thing. What is it, you know, what is it that underlying thing that you've worked through and yarn about when you talk to other brothers? Because it's like a self-destructive thing, you know what I mean? Is it like a low self-worth? Is it... what is it?
You've hit the nail on it when you said talk about it, because men don't talk about it.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what we do. Our whole aim is to start a conversation, because men don't have a conversation. They think if they've got a problem with drinking, then they're less than other men. Then they're less than being what their title should be, a man, you know.
The weak.
And Jeff, obviously, he says, you know, the man's meant to be the dominator. The man's meant to run the house.
Yeah,
you know?
Strong one.
If he's got a problem, then he's not a man, you know. And that's not right. That's not right. Men are the same. They have feelings. They have problems, you know. And I still have those problems today, you know. Just because I don't drink, I don't drug, and I don't gamble doesn't say I don't have problems and I have a perfect life, because I don't, you know. I still have financial struggles. I still have all the struggles I had when I was in addiction, but I react to those situations differently. I don't go to the pub, I don't go to the drug house, I don't go gamble. You know, what I'll do today, if I have a problem, I'll pick up the phone, I'll ring Jeff, or I'll ring someone, I'll ring my partner and say, can we go have a coffee? I've got these things happening that I can't overcome, you know, and they give me the answer. So what we do to these communities is just encourage these men to yarn up, you know, grab a few mates and go sit, light a fire and sit around and have a yarn. Grab your mate and go for a coffee instead of going to the pub. Because a lot of men, they only catch up when it's at the pub or when you're getting on. Mm. It's the only social event, you know, and I have more of a social life today than I had when I was in addiction. The amount of coffee shops I've been in with Jeff.
You know all the coffees now, don't you?
No, coffee lovers. We know a good drop. We even rate a coffee. Every town we go to, we say, what do you give that? He says, I give it about a 7. I say, come on, it'll be better than that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so we've been around a bit too, you know, and the suicide rate for Aboriginal men are number one, you know, and that just says it there, you know, like right there just says, because we don't talk about our problems, it attacks us in so many ways that the answer is let's tap out, you know. Life's too hard, I can't handle it, you know. And for Indigenous men, and not just Indigenous men and women, or just people in general, you know, non-Indigenous people, like, yarning up is the most powerful medicine, I believe, you know, because to get the conversation started is to start yarning up about what the problem is. You know, so that's our aim is to get the communities and say, well, we know how you feel because we were in your shoes. I was in your shoes 8.5 years ago myself, and I know exactly how you're feeling.
Mm.
And the only way I could overcome that is I had to seek help. I couldn't do it by myself. You know, for a long time I tried to, and all it done was it took me to jail. It got me into the dark places of addiction, crime, alcoholism, and pretty much being dishonest to my family in a way where I was walking around my hometown and no one wanted nothing to do with me. You know, I scooped that low. But when I started seeking help, you know, just the freedom I've got, just off the monkey off my back, and like I said, I love my life today. You know, it's just so easy. Just the little things that I'm going to bed in a nice warm bed. You know, little things as that is, I can walk out to my kitchen and I can chuck the kettle on. I can sit in front of my TV with a remote on the lounge. Just them little things, because growing up, I didn't have them luxuries, you know. But we've travelled 25,000 k's in the last 14 months, unfunded.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that, how you get about.
Yeah, we're an unfunded program. That's what we've done, 25,000 k's off our own back.
Just predominantly New South Wales?
We've been down to Phillip Island, Melbourne.
Okay.
New South Wales.
Here in Queensland?
First time up in Queensland, yeah.
It's good to get to Queensland up
with
the.
Oh, yeah, rub it in.
Yeah, you come here, Glenn. It might be your first and last trip now. From Sherbourne, Mollis, look, yeah.
After I said to Steve, I'll get out there. Always had a soft spot for Queensland when I get out there.
Yeah, we better stop in and buy Queensland on the way out.
Yes.
Yeah, but no, we've done it. We've done a lot of kilometres, 25,000 k's, yeah, unfunded. So, but all that's showing me and Jeff is, you know, we're both full time in this now.
You know?
So it's just showing us there's a need, a really, really big need, because you know there is quite a bit of mental health and suicide prevention workshops and talkers out there, but I don't think there's anyone that's come through from drinking, drugging, and gambling who's sort of doing what we're doing at the moment.
This is the thing too, you know, I worked in youth justice for a long time, you know, and I'd worked them young fathers. I knew their older cousins and brothers and all that, you know, because we grew up with them. Our mob connect to people they relate to, and our mob don't want to talk to somebody that don't speak our language, that don't know where we come from or can't relate to, you know what I mean? And it's that thing of being able to sit on the same level and talk at that level.
Exactly right, because my mum often asks, you know, what made you change? Because my mum sat in so many psychiatrists, psychologists, mental health workers, drug and alcohol workers alongside me saying, can you help me, son, you know? Nothing had ever worked. But what worked for me and what worked the first time is when Jeff picked me up and I went and sat around with a lot of recovering alcoholics, addicts, and listened. You know, I wasn't getting told what to do by a person that's never been drunk. You know, so it was about relating, and that's what a lot of this is about, relating. So after we do our talks, we get a lot of people come up saying, I know how you feel. I say, well, good, that's what it's about. Mm.
And not some psychiatrist doing like some psychoanalysis sort of thing and telling you got some disorder or something wrong with you. Yeah.
And I believe there's no more power than someone who walks their talk. You know, I don't think there's any more power than that, than someone who can say, I know he's a feeling because I've been there.
I've walked in your shoes.
Exactly. And that's what I say to Steve. We're walking out talk. You know, we're going to communities, we're talking, and we've walked that life. So, yeah, and we love what we do, you know. We're passionate about what we do, you know. We get away a bit from our families, you know, and like I said, but we just love what we do.
So you're in Queensland at the moment. How many communities are you going to visit?
We're only just out in Cherbourg this whole week. I think we're speaking with the football club and the school. We've got an open community event, which I think there's an organisation from Brisbane taking a small bus of people out. We're meeting with some local elders and stuff. We're going to show us around the community. So we're just going to invest ourselves in the community across the week and try and meet as many people as we can and have some more downtime conversations. I think we're having a nighttime fire yarn up with some men.
And they just found you through Facebook?
Through our Facebook, yeah. But I'd say 90-95% of all of our tours have been generated through Facebook.
Mm.
How many followers you got on there?
I think we've just done about 10,000 now on Facebook.
Yeah. Too good.
What do you think the landscape is like there? Like out there in terms of like rehab and that sort of stuff? And again, you know, I've had to make inquiries for family and all that sort of stuff, and it always seems to be a 2 week or a 3 week waiting list and that sort of stuff.
It's a big thing me and Jeff always talk about, because we've got a lot of people. If an addict and alcoholic puts their hand up for help and they want help, they should get a bed straight away.
Mm.
Unfortunately, that's just not the way the system's working within this country, you know. And if that addict alcoholic wants help, he's told to go and wait, you know. But if he goes and mucks up, there's a bed waiting for him in jail straight away. You know, that's just the way the system's working at the moment, which isn't good. But Jeff spoke at the National Conference of Indigenous Incarceration only about a month ago, and he's just trying to raise that question. You know, if an addict alcoholic wants help, they need to get it straight away, you know, because, you know, they're not planning on any culturally appropriate rehabs at the moment, but what they're planning already is another new prison.
So it's that upstream investment that they need
they're
to be focused on rather than
2028. Yeah. So, and that's what Jeff was put. Well, you're planning to lock your kids up already rather than setting up to help them.
Jeez.
And that's the thing. And it's hard enough sometimes to get your mob to want to go to rehab, and it's like they're ready to go now. You know, we don't know if they're going to, like, there's no chance you get, there's all likelihood not going to be, or they're not going to be around here tomorrow.
Right. And when they put their hand up, they've got to probably wait 2 weeks to get in the detox, and then that's not guaranteeing them a bed when they finish detox. You know, and in an alcoholic addict, if anything like me, if there's not a bed when you finish detox, it's hard to sustain a clean life. You know what I mean? And that's what I said. We go out to Bourke and more Kenya, and these are remote communities that are sort of left out there to defend by themselves, you know. And in a radius of 200 k's out of that way, there's jails pretty much in all these remote communities in a 200 k radius. And for instance, for someone in Bourke, if they want help, they've got to travel 1200 k's to get it. You know what I mean? So that just tells me the reason our gap's not closing for incarceration is because there's too many jails and not enough rehabs.
It's just a system, unfortunately, that's set up that's not going to help you.
Yeah.
Because I've had a family member ask, you know, about going to rehab. You know, you've got to travel 1,200 kilometres to get to rehab. But he's got a partner and kids at home, you know. So if he goes to rehab, that's going to take 70-80% of his Centrelink. What's his partner and kids going to do while they're at home, you know? So he can't go get help because he needs that Centrelink money for misses and kids, not for rehab.
And it's that thing the government don't want to, they want to be seen to be tough on crime.
Yep.
As opposed to sort of, you know, actually dealing with the issues, you know.
Tough on crime, tough on vulnerable people, particularly those who are on Centrelink and stuff like that. Have they got the basics card out with these communities that you've been to?
Yeah, well, my mum lives in Menindee, you know, and they're running on on pretty much rations, running on everything bad out there now, you know. Even me, I took Jeff out there, he's never been out to Menindee. I took him out at the start of the year, you know, and
yeah,
carton of cans of Coke was $64.
$64, it's cheaper to buy a carton of alcohol.
Ooh.
How's that?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And it just tells me I don't know if the system's turning a blind eye, because it's a big market in the jail system now. Really big market, you know. Like, for instance, you go to, there's no tobacco now, like, it's cut out. They're charging $20 in there for one rollie. And a packet of Ox costs $30-$40, and they're charging $400 for a pack in there. It's just a big market now, no matter what.
And this other issue, this thing I was going to say about prisons, you know, again, you know, we hear and we've all known people who've come out with a worse habit from being inside than what they went in with.
You know? Yeah, and that's the thing, like, I've seen a lot of scary stuff in behind them walls, you know. I've seen a man go in there, unfortunately, he's been done drink driving, and the he runs into a judge that's really, really against people drinking driving because his niece was killed by a drink driver, and they're sending them, okay, we'll give you a little, and they're only going in pretty much a part-time drinker, and they're coming out an addict, you know what I mean, because there's drugs and in there that it's easier for me. When I was there, it was easier for me to get on in jail than it was out here. You know what I mean? And they're sending a lot of people to jail that's got issues. You know what I mean? Like, jail's not working. Like, it's not working. Like, they need to be dealing with the core issue. You know what I mean? They're reoffending because of drugs or alcohol. You know, they're under the influence of drugs or alcohol. So how is sending them to jail going to fix that issue?
Yeah, and I think Jeff's sort of a prime example for that point, you know, because I think he was getting sent back and forth in and out, you know, around 10 to 14 years, you know. Back and forth from jail for 14 years for alcohol and drug issues. Until one judge finally said 14 years later, you know, how about you give rehab a go? He went to rehab and he's never picked up drinking drugs since.
Exactly. So I know what works and the statistics, because I was one of them statistics, and jail didn't work.
So rehab was worked for you both the first time?
It wasn't the first time, you know what I mean? I've done, at a younger age, you know, I tried a couple of the rehabs and I wasn't ready then. I don't think I was desperate enough. I don't think I hit a rock bottom where I had nothing else, but rehab was the last roll of the dice, you know, and I was only young, you know, I was pretty young, but this time around, you know, I was 29, 30, you know, and like I said, it came to a point of time where no one wanted nothing to do with me. You know, like I said, my own family sort of brushed me. But I know I only went to that rehab because it was either rehab or jail, because I broke my parole again and parole said, well, let's give rehab a go. And I went to a rehab on the Central Coast, like I said, the Glen. And it's an Indigenous rehab for all cultural people, not just Indigenous men. And I went there, and being an Indigenous man, I believe I've come back in contact with culture in that Indigenous rehab. You know, sitting around that fire and just talking, I started coming back in contact with my culture. I started feeling again, and here I am, like I said, nearly 8.5 years later, still clean and sober.
Steve, you were talking about your you know, career with the NRL, and it you know, there is always a story that crops up about a young NRL player, or even some seasoned ones, you know, mucking up with booze. Was it cocaine? You know, drug dealing and all that kind
of stuff, and league union, cocaine use, and even just the alcohol stuff, you know, the alcohol fuel stuff, and the Mad Mondays, and, you know, following the finals and all that sort of stuff.
What kind of support did you get as a young fella?
None, because I didn't go and ask for it. You know, it would have been there, it could have been there, but I handled every single thing that happened to me on my own. I never asked for help, I never wanted it. In today's game, I know they've got support around everything. You do your mental health training, they do social and emotional wellbeing, they've got Aboriginal liaisons in every club. They're just so well looked after today. Back then, like, this was in, I signed my first contract in 2006, sort of by 2010 I was out of there, but I never received any of that. I didn't ask for it. I probably wasn't on the radar. But as I said, the next time I sort of received help was when, you know, my mum came and picked me up pretty much out of the gutter and said, I'm taking you to get some help, you know. And when I was down there, I wished I did ask for help, because I probably would have got it. And that's the thing, you know, a lot of people don't realise that helps there if you go and ask for it. You know, they're too ashamed to go do it, you know, but I wish I did. But my football career, you know, it didn't even start. You know, I was a good country rugby league player, where I played for country and played for the Australian Institute of Sport and things like that. As soon as I got down to give it a crack in the big league, I knocked it in the head before I even give it a chance, you know, because as soon as I got down there, I started drinking at 18 years old. You know, I never drank as a teenager. Because all I wanted to do was play football. And I remember signing, and I left the West Tigers and went to Cronulla Sharks. And the first thing I did after training was go and have beers with the boys, because I just wanted to fit in. I just wanted to fit in with them, you know. I didn't want to feel like an outsider. And that first beer I picked up, what it done for me was gave me a lot of confidence I never had, because I was a bloke who, pretty much going through my rep levels, I captained nearly every side growing up as a kid. But when I was off that field, I felt like I was less than the kids around me. And no one ever knew that about me, You know, no one ever knew I had these feelings, so I didn't tell them. And when I finally got the grog into me, it just gave me this confidence that I'd never experienced before, and I couldn't put it down, you know. And within 6 months, you know, I was kicked out of that club. I was gone, or I left, I walked out. I walked out on good contracts. And so I never really gave it 10% effort when I got to Sydney, you know. So it's a regret I'll always have. It's a question I'll always ask myself. But in saying that, I'm in the best position I've ever been in my life, you know, and I wouldn't trade it for a thing.
Deadly. We might take a break for a song, eh?
Yeah.
Is,
got a request?
Yeah, got a request. And, you know, country music radio.
He'll say Charlie Pride, Mississippi.
Yeah?
Yeah, chuck her on.
Uncle Charlie?
Charlie, roll on Mississippi. One of my favourite songs.
No worries.
Walking alone, whistling a song, barefoot and fancy free. A big river boat passing us by. She's headed for New Orleans. There she goes. Disappearing around a bend. Roll on, Mississippi. You make me feel like a child again. Cool river breeze, like peppermint leaves. The taste of it takes me back. Chewing on a straw, torn overalls, cane pole and old straw hat. Muddy river, just like a long lost friend. Roll on, Mississippi. You make me feel like a child again. Roll on, Mississippi. Mississippi, big river roll. You're the child of dreams Mississippi, roll on. When the world's spinning round too fast for me, I need a place to dream. So I come to your banks, I sit in your shade, and relive the memories. Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn. Roll on, Mississippi. You make me feel like a child again. Roll on, Mississippi. Big river roll. You're the child of dream I grew up on. Roll on, Mississippi. Mississippi, roll on. Mississippi, roll on.
Roll on, Mississippi, roll on.
Brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service. This is Carver Watson and Karen Durante with Let's Talk.
Welcome back to Let's Talk. We're joined by our guests, Jeff and Steve.
That's him.
From Brothers for Recovery. And we've been talking about both of your stories and the deadly work that you're doing. But, I mean, we touched on it earlier on in the show, the contact that you get through the Facebook and that sort of stuff of people reaching out and asking for advice. What words would you like to share with our families that are listening now or listening at a later date on the podcast? What words would you give them if they've got a family member that's struggling through addiction and in the midst of it?
My strong advice for people, our brothers and sisters that are stuck in that cycle, you know, just be aware of your choices, you know, be aware of your choices because they mightn't affect you today or tomorrow, you know. And just surround yourself with people who you want to be, you know, because pretty much you are who you surround yourself with, you know. And as, if you've just got to, like I said, it's just for me, deep down, it's not normal for our mob to grow up like this, you know. And the world is your oyster, you know. Like I said, the life I live today, I truly dreamed of it when I was laying in my cell, you know, in Bathurst Jail, you know, and Park Lee Jail. And I never ever thought I could imagine living this life, you know. But it's because I put the drink and the drug down, you know, and asked for help, and I received it, you know. I received it, and I dreamed big, you know. And I used to hear it a lot when I was in addiction, you know, whatever you dream, you can achieve, you know. And I never ever thought in my wildest dreams that I'd be where I am today and travelling Australia, telling my story, inspiring people, you know. And if I can do it, so can you.
Yeah, and with me, I guess a big piece of advice I got from Jeff, you know, early on, is don't wait to lose what you have before you do something about it, you know, because at the time I still had that partner, I had those kids, and a lot of people in addiction, they still have them loved ones, you know, and they wait to lose them before they try and do something about it. So don't wait till you get to that session, you know, wait till you get to that point in life. And, you know, when I started to get a couple of months up, the fog was clearing, you know, and it's sort of a point where I could have went back when those problems were happening, you know. And Jeff again, you know, he just said, have a crack at life, you know, have a crack and you'll surprise yourself, you know. And I did, and I put my head down my ass and I had a crack, you know. I done the work I needed to get where I am today, you know, and I'm reaping the rewards, you know. As I said, I'm marrying the mother of my kids, you know. We've got a car in the driveway, we've got food in the fridge for my kids, you know. They've got clothes on their back, you know. And that stuff wasn't always around because I drank or gambled or drugged all the money, you know, but because I had a crack and I really believed in myself, it's all behind me now.
Mm.
Another big important youth services in your community.
Yep.
That's one of my biggest advice too, you know. And the services are there for you to use, you know, because a lot of us black fellas don't like going in and using services, you know what I mean? They don't like walking in and approaching and putting their hand up for help, you know. But you'd be surprised if you use the services in your community, what are there and funded, that's why they're funded, is to help you, you know what I mean? So just be aware of the services in your community, and if you need them, go and seek them. Go and seek the help you need at them services.
Mm. Ask for help.
Ask for help.
Ask for help.
I'm glad I did.
Save me life.
It's not weak to speak. You know,
and if it's not culturally appropriate, at least if you access that service and they say, oh, shit, we got black fellas using the service now, we better have a rap plan happening and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly. Right. And a lot of the services probably are not cultural appropriate services, you know what I mean? But it's a start. You know what I mean? They might be able to refer you to something that's more beneficial for you. You know what I mean? So if you can use them services for a stepping stone to get the help you need, why not?
And on the flip side, we also, when we go to communities, we encourage those services to, you know, we keep them accountable too. You know, you're in that position, you've got the power to change, get out there and knock on the doors and stop waiting for them to come to you as well.
You were saying, mob know you're there.
Yeah. You were saying before that you're unfunded. Do you want to stay that way? Because I just wonder whether, you know, people, you know, might see.
Eventually, to keep going, we're going to need to be funded. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I think in the long run, it's only so long we can keep being paid for our service, you know. And to be honest, there's a lot of communities, there's a lot of schools, there's a lot of targeted groups, and there's a lot of stuff we'd like to implement, but we can only do so much with what we be
allocated
paid for, I suppose. So to say we want to take men on camp nights, you know, we want to go to these communities that don't have the funds to get us there, you know. We want to go to these hurting communities, these hurting families and help, but we can only go as far as people want to pay us at the moment. So in the long run, probably a little bit of funding might help. But at the moment, you know, we're going okay. But, yeah, I'd say in the long run, a bit of funding won't hurt to get us to the places that really need us.
And so we can implement in that service, in that community a bit more. Because, like I said, if we can go into communities and sort of get the feel of that community and the trust of them people in that community, and when we're coming back, they know that we're sort of, we've walked their life, you know. And we can, like Steve said, we can put on a barbecue, we can take the men and sit around a fire at night and do some men's business. And because a lot of men won't speak up around women. You know, we spoke...
Well, you three haven't been able to shut up since
you've been here, hey? Yeah, I know, because we spoke at a community and they had a lot of DV men there, you know, domestic violence men. And once we told our story, some of these men that
they put their hand up, and when we asked, is there anything people would like to talk about, and one man nearly he started crying when he was telling them about what he does when he's drunk, you know, to his the people he loves the most, you know. Yeah. And just stuff like this, you know, you've got to adapt, and you've got to adapt your speak around your audience too, you know, because we go to schools, we go to jails, we go to, and we sort of can't talk as raw in schools than we do in jails.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So.
Well, I don't know.
Eventually, yeah.
Might work talking to them young ones about it, as rough as you do talk to the ones that are in jail.
Yeah, well, you
wake them up or something. Yeah. I don't know.
Yeah.
Was that Scared Straight, like that show in the what's name? Yeah. Yeah. They take all them young fellas to jail.
Yeah, no, we've got to be careful with them, because, you know, a lot about what we do, you know, a lot of these men, they need to be loved back to life, and so do these kids, yeah. You know. So if we go there with a raw attitude and, you know, swearing around these kids, you know, it's just what they hear at home, unfortunately.
Yes.
You know? So it just maybe trigger them even more. So we've got to be careful with these kids and try and love them back to life.
We can get
their
trust first, you know what I mean? Like I said, and if we're funded, we can go back and we can interact with these kids a bit more. And
yeah.
We can sort
so
of
quite often it's
these
just
kids.
A one-off visit sometimes.
Surely we can mentor these kids when we're back there, or we can keep in contact with them, and because a lot of kids come up and want photos with us when we tell our stories in schools, and they inbox us, and you know, like, so
it'd be good to really invest ourselves in that community a little bit more over, you know, four times across a year, just to really invest ourselves in it and see the progress in people, rather than open up these can of worms, open up these old scars with them and saying good luck with life, you know, we're out of here.
Yeah,
but I mean, that's an important, I always think about the failure of the education system to actually educate young people about the real issues in life, you know, particularly in the communities you know, you fighters grew up in, and communities that so many of our mob grow up in, and the actual circumstances and issues that they're faced with, you know, not just algebra, you know. Equal MC squared, you know. What's that got to do when you got, you know, brother, father, uncle, whoever getting locked up, you know, bullying at the door every second day because parole breaches or whatever, what have you. It's that practical sort of education, you know.
It is.
Knowing that you're not, there's nothing wrong with you, that these things happen.
No, just nothing wrong. It's just like myself. I wasn't a bad person. I was just a sick person having a rough trot, you know. I was just having a rough trot in life, and I just needed that bit of guidance to sort of spear me in the right direction, you know.
Yeah.
And say, well, there you go, you're on your own for 2 feet now, it's up to you.
Yeah, and that's, I suppose, with the I'm pretty passionate about the education system rather than mentoring and programs, you know. I've got a big emphasis on the kids need to be mentored through the teenage years, not told what to do, you know, because a lot of kids are told what to do rather than someone asking why you're doing this. You know, instead of someone asking why you're doing it, and stop pointing the finger at them and ask them why they're doing it rather than tell them what to do, you know. And I'm really big on that teenage year education, so I really believe there needs to be a lot more of what we do, mental health. There needs to be a lot more campfires, a lot more camps, a lot of programs, rather than sitting in and doing things that, you know, because at 14, 15, 16 years old, you're in there doing mathematics when you don't care about it and you don't want to do it in life. Then why do it?
And I think there was a conversation that we had with somebody who talked about the habits that we form in life happen around those formative years in your sort of mid to late teens. So,
instead of someone telling me when, you know, because I was at school, I was really, really uneducated, you know. My friends around me were in the good classes, I don't think I ever got higher than 10% in an exam or anything like that, but I was made feel less because of it, you know. And someone said to me, don't judge a fish by about how high he can climb a tree. You know, he's meant to do other things.
Yeah.
And that's that thing of all those things that go on, not pretending like they don't exist. It's dealing with it front on and having those conversations, you know.
I went to the Indigenous incarceration. I was mind blown to see that it's costing $800 million a year to lock our kids up. Indigenous kids. That's only Indigenous kids. $800 million a year. Surely there's a better way to be spending money to
that money,
cultural programs for our kids to keep them out of the system.
Buy them a house.
Yeah, house in their own house.
You know,
that's just Indigenous kids. You know what I mean? So, and when I heard that, I was mind blown.
That
cost an $800 million.
Imagine if they were like just guaranteed a job in their community doing something they enjoy. You know, or they're given a scholarship or something. You know,
they just need mentors in their community to direct these kids in the right direction.
That's what the kids need. The kids need mentors. Our kids need mentors, and the men in our community need to stand up and mentor those kids.
Yeah. Well, on that note,
where can we find Brothers for Recovery?
We've got our Facebook page, Brothers for Recovery. It's a number four, so Brothers for Recovery. And I think Jeff's running an Instagram page too now. So, so there's probably more about selfies rather than
gym selfies.
All I've got to do is go on Facebook, copy and paste, just screenshot his
mate. Yeah, so it'll be full of selfies and coffees.
Just did me 50 push-ups this morning. Deadly.
Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us here.